Welcome everyone to Heritage Matters webinar 2 entitled Civic Spaces in Time of Crisis. Now, those of us working in architecture, design, museums, public planning and everything, we always talk about civic spaces. So what exactly do civic spaces mean in times of crisis? I've been in emergencies way, working in Afghanistan, Indonesia after the tsunami. Civic spaces are where people congregate outside during an earthquake, or the people are not told to stay inside. But here, in this this crisis, we're being told to stay inside, indoors, not come out. So our whole engagement with the outside has changed quite dramatically. We don't know what will happen in future, how our spaces will be limited, transformed, and the future's imagined. There's some people who are saying that, oh, look, you know, once everything gets back to normal, people will go back to their own same old ways. Nothing is going to change. I'm not of that opinion. I think that the recreational spectrum of arts, culture, museum, heritage, environment, a whole range of things, it's going to be, you know, imagined differently. Some of the old, some of the new, some of the more creative side of, you know, what is possible. Urbanism, local neighborhoods, city centers, are they going to be redefined, redelineated? These are some of the issues that we need to discuss. And one thing that comes very close to reality is what Professor Arjun Appadurai, former provost of New School in New York, has said in, you know, in his article on grassroots globalization and the Pukhar project in Mumbai that he and his late wife Brenda started years ago, is that with globalization, we're really engaging only with about 20% of the population. But the bottom 20%, although they have the impacts, they come under the impacts of globalization, but they're not really participating. So are we only about 20% of middle-class people who are directly engaged in all these activities that are actually determining what are civic spaces, and how do we, this crisis give us the chance to go beyond our middle-class perception of what a public space is? Will it enable us to rethink? Will it enable us to be more inclusive, bring in multiple voices of people that we don't normally think about? These are some of the issues that I pose to our panelists. We have a fantastic, you know, panel of panelists. We have Brenda Somaya, Principal Architect Somaya and Kalapa Consultants, Mumbai, A.D. White, Professor at Large of Cornell University, USA, and Chairperson of Board of Governors School of Planning and Architecture, Vijayawada. And then she will speak for about 8 minutes and will be followed by Harsh Thapar, architect and sustainability expert, vice president of HKS Architects, which is US based. He's the vice president. We're very lucky to have him, you know, based in Delhi from time to time or most of the time. And then we have the next generation voice, the youth. What do they think about it all? Through Pratima Muniappa, design researcher from Space Enabled Group, MIT Media Lab, Cambridge, USA. She was a Fulbright Fellow, has a master's in design studies in critical conservation from Harvard University. She was a Young India Fellow 2013-14. She's a graduate of National Institute of Design, Ahmedabad. And I must add that she did the Vietnam Field School with me, you know, a few years ago. And so we have a fantastic panel. I think that we're going to kickstart, and there'll be no detailed introductions because most of you would have Googled them or found them online anyway. So we'll start off with Brenda Somaya. Brenda, how do you imagine the future, you know, sitting inside the way we are?
Well, thank you, Amar, and it's a pleasure to be here with Harsh and Pratima as well. I just thought I would, you know, you had mentioned in your note to me that perhaps we should take 3 points. And I always remember learning that It's very difficult for anyone to absorb more than 3 points at a time. So I thought I would just give a sort of a broad introduction in the sense that what was and could be the role of civic spaces, and then what will be the role of technology in these spaces as we move into the future, and finally, what will be the role of the citizen, what would be the agency that we need to think about. So taking these 3 points, I'll just run through a few ideas I had thought. Now, we all know that that civic spaces are so important. In India, I see our civic or community space continuously has been in crisis for some time, for several reasons. So I look at this as one more crisis that has come in our path. We have had several crises with civic spaces and community spaces. So perhaps I will touch on those, and then I will just come to the particular COVID-19 situation. So I would like to quote something from an article from an internet project for public spaces, where they say that civic spaces are an extension of the communities we live in when they work well. They serve as a stage for our public lives. So in India, whether it was the village center under a banyan tree, all of us have worked over there sitting a group of people, or whether it was the grand courtyards and collection spaces of Jaipur palaces, or whether it is our wonderful Hampi, the civic spaces around the markets, or perhaps in front of the temples, or coming to our colonial cities, whether it is the Oval Maidan in Mumbai or the Gateway of India. So all these are important because they give us our sense of identity, and they also give a character to the town or the city around. And we know this particularly in European cities who have managed to retain their civic centers and the community spaces very well. Unfortunately, in India, for various reasons, but perhaps one of the most important would be the population pressures, we have been losing these civic spaces over the last few decades. And even if they do exist, it is often the very privileged and the few who have access to them. And the rest are getting more and more enclosed within the minimal spaces that they have in their residences or where they live. And it's a great pity because these spaces bring great economical and environmental benefits to the community, as we know with waterfronts or beaches or anything else. And particularly so in India, because our lives are not really separate from our history or our geography or our culture. And of course, of our architecture. Being an architect, I have to say, the mother of all arts. So all this becomes so integrated, and they cannot be put into compartments and separated as well. So in terms of crisis, what changes? You know, there are naturally short, medium, and long-term impacts, and hence they have to be short, medium, and long-term solutions. There's not going to be one shoe that fits all. So all of us today in lockdown, we understand how much has changed. But today, those of us participating, as you mentioned, Amar, just now, or even listening to this webinar, are such a privileged minority in a country like ours. And our hearts go out to the rest of our population who don't have this. It's really moving what is happening everywhere. But more than ever, we accept that the virtual is not, particularly in India, a long-term solution for authentic human interaction. And I feel very strongly about that. The current crisis reinforces the vital role that public places will play, continue to play, in bringing people together, particularly in a country like India, thus promoting their health and well-being. We sitting in our homes can watch movies, we can watch theater, dance, music, everything, because of the role of technology. But how do we ensure that post-COVID, that this access is for everyone? So this time of the pandemic and its effects have given us time to observe, reflect, and modify, if required, our thoughts, our actions, and our goals as we move ahead. So we need agency, the capacity of individuals to act independently and make free choices. We can prioritize nature and sustainability when we build new or preserve the old. We have to redefine, we have to think anew, and we have to discuss and debate, but with hope. Can't hear you, Amar. Amar.
Okay, Amar. Okay, yes, I got the mic on. Oh, thank you, Brinda. That was great. And towards the end, you hinted about a kind of dynamism that is needed, you know, short term, medium term, long term. But this is a different kind of dynamic that we anticipate as we move forward. So, Harsh, on that note, could you share with us your reflections?
Can you guys hear me? It's all okay? Hi, Amar. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, you can. Okay, cool. So yeah, thank you everybody for joining us here for this webinar today. And I really hope you all are keeping safe amid COVID. As Amar mentioned, and some of you probably know, I'm a practicing architect. I'm deeply passionate about sustainable design and how, you know, building and outdoor spaces can be kind of created more sustainably. And to this effect, I have been pushing forward the agenda of building science and using advanced simulation techniques to inform design processes and, you know, hopefully having some impact on boardroom decisions that really impact our work. So I just want to tell you that I have that, you know, sustainable built, you know, environment background. And, you know, in light of that, I wanted to share, you know, my 3 points. So I'm following Amar's, you know, suggested methodology. And I feel these 3 points, though they are known, but they're not really on top of the discussion agenda. And hence, I want to raise it today. So the first point is going to be about the link between COVID-19 and environmental degradation. Second is that, you know, we have to create new models and propagate them rapidly. And the third is that we better not forget what we are learning and absorbing during this lockdown period. So let me go with the first one. According to UNEP, about 75% of all emerging infectious diseases are zoonotic. That means they are actually emerging out of animals, whether they're domestic or wild. They're getting transferred to human beings. And there are about one new infectious disease every 4 months. So I wish to highlight that, you know, we need to really take some radical steps towards, you know, protection of our natural habitats. You know, stop creating monocultures, stop illegal trade. We just need to take care of our natural heritage, right? And these 4 to 5 weeks have shown us various examples, you know, of how nature is healing itself as we have actually decreased our activity levels. So putting it in context of, you know, the Paris Agreement, you know, we are all, you know, aiming for this 1.5 degree C temperature increase or less, you know, hopefully. But, you know, our carbon emissions are rising 6% every year. So you would have, you know, seen the silver lining, you know, of COVID-19, perhaps the only one, where, you know, we see International Energy Association predicts that there's going to be 8% decline in carbon emissions this year. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, we don't need to rejoice about it because this is not happening because of any structural change in our economic setup. What you're seeing here is probably going to be reversed as soon as the lockdown opens. Like in 2009, there is actually records of how just after the, you know, kind of recession, actually the economy bounced back, we actually kind of had huge carbon and energy consumption, which actually kind of reversed all the benefits that we may have actually got. So in short, health of the planet is intimately tied up to our health. And that is something which is, you know, needs to be recognized and addressed this point on, right? Whether it be buildings, our spaces, or, you know, our economy. for that matter. So jumping on to my second point, I wanted to convey that, you know, we are operating in a situation of crisis right now. And, you know, as Brinda also pointed out, crisis is a situation where, you know, people, heritage, art, culture, things which we really pride ourselves in a democracy, they don't thrive. So I think it is time that we, you know, some of us at least who can, take a strategic long-term approach, right? What are the things we really want to actually change post this lockdown, what people call the new normal, right? And there are a few opportunities which I'm seeing, so which I want to raise. So you must have heard about the Indian government, you know, taking out stimulus package, you know, for our economy, and various kind of countries are doing that to kind of help the business enterprises which are, you know, really troubled. So now is the opportunity where, as responsible citizens, we need to find ways to prioritize sustainable projects. You know, we need to prioritize healthcare, we need to prioritize, you know, forestry, you know, heritage, culture related projects, you know, efficiency projects, slum redevelopment. You know, there's a big issue of density, what's happening in Dharavi. You know, can we improve the situation? We need to capture the real, you know, projects with real benefits instead of potentially the government actually investing a lot of money into mega infra projects with potentially a lot of benefits for large construction companies, right? So the other point which I really, you know, I've been listening to is that a lot of people in my industry, which is architecture, engineering, construction industry, I've been talking about, you know, how this is really the time to really invest in technology, you know, look at, you know, faster ways to construct stuff, modularization, prefab technology. So there is this continuous focus of what's next in business, right? But we also, you know, see that lacks of our labor and our craftsmen, you know, and our, you know, artists are going to go out of work, you know, or they have already gone out of work. So how do you kind of align and, you know, kind of both of these kind of contrasting things? Is there a way to use technology, but yet keep, you know, this in mind that technology needs to benefit many? Right? So in that context, you know, of technology, right, there is this opportunity of, you know, what is emerging as a digital civic space, right? People don't have all access. You know, I totally agree with Brinda. There is about 68% of people in rural areas, which may be kind of compromised in terms of, you know, internet or digital access. 30% of our population is below poverty line. So they cannot really sit like us, you know, and enjoy, you know, work from home. So how is it that, you know, that we make that better with the technology and the changes that are going to come, you know, forth, right? And we would be the ones kind of envisioning those changes, implementing those changes as well. So I think there were ideas which were emerging, you know, can we help, you know, the rural children with kind of virtual education, digital education? Is it telehealth that's going to help them? Or we need to go and dig deeper, you know, because I think COVID-19, or if climate change really comes the way, you know, it's being predicted, is going to put not just our cities, but our rural population into crisis. And it's going to challenge not just the way our buildings work, but the very way, you know, our culture works, you know, and how we kind of interact with people. So it's a big thing, and we need to be strategic about it, right? a report in KPMG says that there's this 21-day lockdown, you know, the lockdown 1.0 costed us $120 billion, right? And I think perhaps this is the time that, you know, environmental accounting also starts, you know, to feature into these numbers. Because, I mean, if we don't give value to, you know, things we are seeing now, then when would we do that, right? And in that context, you know, I really have a few words regarding green buildings, you know, which I have worked extensively on. And, you know, they are really good instruments. But, you know, what has happened is that they have actually now been kind of employed by, you know, as tools by business as usual industry to, you know, justify almost any project, right? So I do not, you know, even though I am deeply entrenched in the, you know, kind of sustainable design green building industry, I almost feel that I am looking for game-changing stuff. And what is that game-changing stuff? What is it that can actually take us well beyond net zero carbon? What is it that, you know, can actually take us toward the regenerative you know, future regenerative projects, you know, if I can kind of propose that as a word. So, you know, COVID-19 has given us a peep into the issues that future holds. Some say it has fast forward the impacts that are going to come with climate change, the challenges that are going to come for our civic life, culture, art heritage, you know, we think today is going to come in a major way in the future. So we have an opportunity to revisit our preferred vision. What is it that we want to create, right? But the real challenge, I feel, and I wanted to kind of share that as a warning for myself, for everybody, is that public memory is short, you know, and what we feel is often forgotten. So, you know, we must remember that, you know, the final bottom line, you know, so we've heard about, you know, the triple bottom line. The final bottom line is actually health. And that is dependent on the health of our ecosystem. So let's give that priority. And that's all from me for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Harsh. It's absolutely nailed it, you know, sort of environmental accounting and not forgetting, you know, because we do have amnesia, like you mentioned, you know, and we forget our memories are short. Now, you have suggested, you know, more than methods and modalities, you know, sort of as we move forward that take into consideration a whole range of factors, environmental, social, economic and cultural. And Brinda has talked about the agency. So Pratima, what does it all mean to you? You know, you deal with cosmologies, agency, you know, what preferred futures do you anticipate? You have to, Pratima, you have to, we can't hear you.
Am I audible?
Yeah, now you're audible. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Harsh and Brinda, for this sort of like extremely enlightening position. And I've been reflecting too about, you know, from both as, I think, as a human and as a professional, what this current situation means to me, what our future is going from here. And what I find really incredible is how one small sort of market transaction or an event in Wuhan brings us face to face with the interconnectedness of all the constituents in the world. It really kind of shatters once and for all the myth of the impermeability of our borders. And it draws our attention really, like Harsh was saying, to the provenance of this pandemic, you know, and makes us reflect on the fact that this disease emerges from an ecology. And when we look historically at all of the data that we have, the research that we've done on past pandemics, each time there's been a really violent clash between humans and wildlife or incursions of development into areas that should have been designated as forests or conservation spaces, we've had diseases. I mean, like for example, AIDS, I think, came from like rapid deforestation in West Africa and a violent clash between poachers and a band of chimpanzees where the virus hopped over, and it like, we can't help but ignore can't help but come face to face with the fact that disease as it stands today is an environmental issue. When we look towards the future and the conservation of spaces, I mean, we have to look at the fact that 70% of all the most biodiverse areas in the world are in the hands of people who self-identify as indigenous people. And these people are the most historically marginalized and dispossessed among in the world. And we have to look, I think, to policy and actions that protect these communities as well as protect these knowledge systems. And in a strange way that, you know, with the COVID crisis and the way this virus attacks our elderly and the most vulnerable is our elderly, in a similar way, I think that the climate crisis the climate crisis depends on the knowledge that our elders embody. And the two are intricately linked. And I think that we need, going forward, radical support for indigenous groups and indigenous stewardship of ecological resources. And I think in this moment of pause, digital documentation might be one way forward. And I think that, like, one of the things that I've been dwelling on really is how this is also not just a crisis, you know, of human health, but it's also a crisis really of narrative. And there's a really incredible, like, in The Great Derangement, Amitav Ghosh makes the claim once that climate change, or who's responsible for climate change, is actually authors, because he makes the argument that around the 1900s, there was a shift in which authors and writers and people who produce cultural artifacts shifted away from dealing with these large, bigger than supernatural events. And the world of, like, authorship started to think about more mundane events that happened at the everyday. And because of this shift, climate left the ordinary imagination. And in some way, I think that the fact is that today, with corona crisis, we're using the metaphor of war, a war against biology, a war against the planet itself. And I think that this is a crisis of narrative, in a sense that it's really important for us to seize the narrative and talk about the virus as being intricately linked to ecology and ecosystems. For example, right now, with this whole kind of wartime narrative, there's Trump in America who's fashioning himself as a wartime president, invoking the Defense Production Act. The world all over is seeing curfews and lockdowns to combat the virus. There's a state of emergency that allows governments unprecedented power over corporate manufacturing and narrative programming. And all of this comes, I think, with the danger of the politics of otherness. Like, we're calling this a Chinese virus. There's acts of blatant racism around people from the northeast of India. For example, there is a real danger in, rather than invoking heritage and culture's expansive potential to nurture a sense of identity, to reinforce social cohesion or facilitate reconciliation, we're instead sort of participating in politics of otherness, using stereotypes of race or religion to trigger conflict, to perpetuate or reinforce symbols of oppression and generate trauma. I mean, for example, not 24 hours had passed from the announcement of the lockdown and the curfew, but the government had also, like, attempted to clear the protest sites in Shaheen Bagh of their posters. At the same time, for example, I think that work had continued on the government's plans to redevelop the Central Vista in the 4-kilometer stretch from Rashtrapati Bhavan to India Gate. And this really shows, like, what happens when you seize control of what narrative and what narratives are privileged in times of crisis. And the trouble with this kind of wartime psychology, or using the metaphor of war, is that we constrain our imagination, I think, to thinking about a very short-term war mobilization. And it blinds us to to insidious kind of global problems, as equipment shortage, healthcare disparity, the lack of emergency protocols, poverty, and social inequality that can't be addressed by this kind of neat, rapid, offensive goal against COVID. So even if the battle is metaphoric, I think it really falls to us to resist the monoculture of the plantational scene, and for the wildness of plurality, of diverse and simultaneously valid cultural ontologies. And I think that it leads us to this idea that we need to strengthen methods of digital resistance, and we need now more than ever the continued persistence of dissent. And in a weird, I mean, you know, the crisis has only ended up accelerating the kind of inequity that persists in the world today. Those that are historically marginalized, that are dispossessed, are now the most vulnerable people within the crisis. And as it stands today, I think, like, we've pit ecological flourishing against economic activity, and a reduction in one leads to a bloom in the other. And I think that in this moment of pause where, you know, economies have shut down, we also come really face to face with the nature of our skeletal selves as consumers, like in a marketplace where that is now being driven by what is essential, we come face to face also with what is superfluous. And I think that as a government, just about bailouts to big businesses that are the chief culprits of climate change, we should also be thinking about stimulus packages to crafts or culturally cohesive sectors. And we should look towards, I think, drawing the gaze of the impact investing sector towards, like, economically cohesive, ecologically cohesive businesses. And again, like Harsh said, you know, that there was this, like, radical bloom in consumption post the 2008-09 crisis. Like, it really makes me wonder whether this period of pause sows the seeds for a radical reimagination of previous modes of consumption, of extraction, of production, or does it entail a race really towards restoring the status quo? And I think that, you know, as a designer, as, you know, being from the Media Lab and watching the very forefront or the cutting edge of technology, one of the things that makes me incredibly hopeful about the future as designers is how, you know, like there's a shift in biology where before, maybe 20, 30 years ago, we used to think of the unit, the individual or the unit, if the individual is the main unit of biology. But right now the shift is where we're looking at the system or the network as the fundamental unit in biology. And if that's the case, and if the human is no longer central within the way we design systems, within the way we choose to intervene in the world, I'm really interested in methods where we design as companion species, where we recognize that we are linked to an ecology, and we design consistently thinking about a materials ecology and how it moves through the ecosystem. And I think keeping these principles in mind and trying to wear nature's face is what's going to, is, I think, an attempt. I mean, that's what's going to help us in this moment of reflection and going forward.
Thank you, Pratima. That's wonderful, wonderful and very eloquently put. And can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
You can hear me, right? Now, very eloquently put. I think one thing that's underneath, you know, all of this discussion is that we have colonial legacies of nature-culture dichotomy, which is alien. For example, in a country like India, or anywhere in Africa or Asia, the dichotomy was introduced during colonial times. Nature, culture, nature is something to be conquered, you know, tamed, and that's continued as a nature-culture dichotomy. We haven't really decolonized the environmental discourse from this. It's still model after model, which still separates nature and culture. What you're arguing is to take that holistic approach that indigenous people have, you know, sort of in their worldview, that holistic approach. Harsh, do you want to comment, because you were raising some of the issues that, yeah.
Well, thanks for, summarizing, what Pratima was saying. It's super interesting. I thought, this whole, two points which, you and Pratima raised. One is this crisis of narrative, I think is a brilliant way to look at it, because all across media right now, it's a war against COVID. And I think if there was a better narrative, perhaps we can actually move to looking at it like a system. Right, just connecting two points which Pratima mentioned, what would be a narrative where we could actually kind of start looking at COVID as a system, something to be solved, by looking at the network and the system. So that would be my suggestion. I mean, maybe, we can get some comments from Binda on that. Second is decolonization of environmental discourse. I think it's something really, really pertinent, Amar. I think it is all through, the way we are doing business, the way we are looking at the environment. It is something that we want to resolve and manage rather than understand and allow to flourish and us being just one of the components. So I think the approach is totally the other way. And how can we change this is really a big question.
Thank you, Harsh. Brinda, there are questions coming up. One of the questions which I'd really appreciate if you could address is that right now there's a kind of duality of community participation containing COVID, but also everywhere in the world, governments are imposing very strong sanctions, and quite rightly, in order to contain in many ways. The question is that how do we get that local community participation back into the civic space? Is that being contained right now? Is the public seen as government and the private seen as a community engagement? I mean, how do we rethink this? Would you like to comment on that? That's one of the things that's coming up here. You have to unmute your mic.
There are no easy answers to many of the questions that both Harsh and Pratima raised. I think we have to accept that we have currently, there is a big danger, whether it came from Wuhan, whether it's due to the environment, whether it's due to ecology, whether it's due to the way we think, whether it's due to the colonial leftover, whatever it is, there's a huge issue in the world today. And that is definitely going to be what is going to be addressed first by all countries. Now, how these countries and their individual governments take advantage of the situation and how different countries use it for different ways to bring in legislation or to bring in rules or to bring in ideas which are not what the population at large really would like, but because we're overshadowed by the situation today, it sort of gets lowered in priority. And I know what Harsh mentioned, or you did, about the Central Vista, about so many other issues, whether it was the riots which took place in Delhi. All these things have, Shaheen Bagh, all these things have taken a back foot because of what has happened. Now, what's really going to be important for us to be able to bring this back again into discourse after things sort of settle down, because I don't see that anything's going to happen really fast. It's not as though next month we're all going to go back into a different world than is currently with us now. And I think that's very important to understand that there are many, many issues. For instance, I read recently that the Brazilian government has again opened, during this time of COVID, a large part of the Amazon forest for felling during this time. At the same time, I've got online from the Tata Group how they are selling saris, which the tribal women are making in one part of India, and they're asking us all to buy a sari through technology. So, the world has about 8-9 billion people today from hardly, you know, over the last whatever thousands of years. And there's not going to be one easy answer. Things are so complex. And for me, what's really important, that what is the change each one of us is going to make? What has each one done to change their lives? Have we decided not to travel abroad anymore? Have we decided not to fly? Have we decided to cut down what we buy and what we eat? Have we decided to cut down our electricity bill? It's easy to talk, but what contribution has each one of us personally made towards what we are talking about and what we see in the future? We can't change everything. It's impossible for us, neither the young, nor the middle-aged, nor the old, all of whom are represented today. But what efforts are we making? What are we trying to even do towards that change? Positively, I mean, actual things. And we should never feel that one person can't make the difference. I think that's what's overwhelming often. So to me, that's really going to be what the road ahead is going to be. What are the changes that we make personally after we come out of this, to the way we think, the way we behave, what we write about, what we believe in, and then how do we spread this among other people or try and convince them as well? Because otherwise we're going to go back to what we always do and keep expounding theoretical knowledge.
Yeah.
So, Amar, if I could, you know,
thanks, Brenda,
your permission add to that.
Yeah, sure.
So I think,
go ahead.
Brenda, you know, touched on the point of, you know, she'd raised earlier as well, agency, you know, and you know, of each individual to, you know, really have an impact on the situation. And I think broadly, you know, looking at it, I think we would be looking forward to somehow stabilizing the system. You know, what I detect, you know, after working, you know, for quite a few years in this, you know, area of sustainable design, is that, you know, there's more and more news about, you know, destabilization of ecosystems, right? We're really disturbing everything. So how do you really kind of strategically start, you know, stabilizing them? And I think in that context, I think Brenda is in Mumbai, and I think there's a big question. You know, I think it's an individual question as well as, you know, question about, you know, the country as a whole. It's about, you know, our population, you know, and of course the density, you know, of certain parts of our cities, which, you know, we would as designers also, you know, really have to look at, you know, the issue of, you know, the population of the countries is a much larger question. But I do feel that, you know, a country like India needs to really actually plan, you know, for on this aspect as well, if, you know, we need to stabilize our ecosystem. Otherwise, the densities are very high, you know, really, you know, have impacts.
Harsh, that's following on from that is a question. You know, there are two non-negotiables. One is environmental conservation is non-negotiable. Economic development is also non-negotiable when the huge number of people are below the poverty line and there need to be opportunities. The question is, in this context that is being asked, is that does this situation right now, the COVID situation, give us an opportunity to rethink public-private partnerships in future, bringing both the environmental and the economic together?
I think it's, so I'm thinking on the go, because I think it's a big question that you actually really posed. But, you know, I mean, I would probably jump back to my point that, you know, I think somehow there is a lot of discussion about how this partnership can be executed at the cities. You know, for example, you know, how do you manage civic spaces or city, you know, public transport systems, you know, how would, you know, and then that would be, you know, a good opportunity, you know, for example, like, you know, Uber or Ola, you know, kind of providing services, you know, during COVID, you know, for certain, you know, sections of the people, you know, for the sick. But also, I think there would be a big opportunity. There was this, you know, mega project that was launched by Government of India regarding, you know, housing for all, right? And I think we need to really kind of re-envision that in light of, you know, the whole COVID situation. How can we actually create houses which are much higher quality, much more sustainable, less energy consuming, better ventilation, yet, you know, kind of not breaking the Indian cultural ethos, right? So just building, you know, these 3 to 8 story towers is really probably not the solution. So that could be a mega project where, you know, public-private partnership could really have an impact, right? By improving, by giving jobs and opportunities for people, but yet actually really having a direct impact short term as well as long term. You know, just an idea which I could come up right now. But there would be many such projects, right?
The most important thing here in India is, unless there is political will and bureaucratic will, it is almost impossible to get things done. So we have to start believing that we as individual citizens need to work towards that. I, in my own small way, have tried. Many times I have failed. Projects that have almost happened, we didn't get support at the end, and it's fallen through. So it's, for instance, well, let's talk about Dharavi. There have been hundreds of solutions for Dharavi. There have been solutions from, brilliant solutions from all the architecture schools in Mumbai, of which we have 12. There's been a worldwide competition for solutions. But unless the land where Dharavi stands is given to the people who currently occupy it in totality or almost in totality, there is never going to be a solution for it. And that means developers have to give up their greed, the politicians have to give up their greed, and the bureaucrats have to go along with what is truly important for the people of this city.
Thank you, Brenda. Pratima, would you like to comment? Where is Pratima? I think we've lost Pratima. But there's another question that's coming from there are a number of questions that are coming up. And we got participants from 46 countries. So you got to think of that. One of the questions that's coming up is, you know, as we rethink our civic spaces, what kind of cultural narrative would architects and designers, you know, would find, you know, to be more inclusive? So that's a question to all of you. Because you got to build up bottom up, that's what they're saying.
What's interesting is we have 850 million smartphones in India today. And a large portion of the public of this country are going to get their entertainment through technology. So what is going to be important is content. How are you going to be able to bridge the gap of what you believe is worthwhile and be able to communicate this to the people of this country? Apart from the fact that they will continue with the folk traditions, the village traditions, all our wonderful classical music, our, you know, coming from our 20 odd states, our dance, our history, all that will continue in its own way. But I think we have to look at this quantum leap, this jump that's happening. We see it all around us. Look around you anytime. What are people sitting and doing? It doesn't matter where they are. They might be in a little village hut, or they might be in a big city. They're looking at their phones. And what are they looking at?
If I could just add to that, I mean, you're absolutely right. And in a way, I think that one distinguishing feature is the difference between civic spaces as digital presences and civic spaces as physical presences. And I think the difference between a Marina Beach in Chennai or the Oval Maidan is that it truly enables a democratization of access from the very, very rich to the very, very poor. And I don't know if it's the same for you, but it has been for me that over the last few years, I've been watching my social media, my Facebook, my Instagram, all shrink to become an echo chamber. I seem to be collecting people who think the same way as me, who have the same beliefs as me, and that if the nature of these algorithms is to push out polarized voices. And I think that it becomes really interesting. It's not just a question of what narratives, it's also a question of how many narratives can we simultaneously hold as valid and all really true. Everybody has a right to their own kind of plural opinion. And I think that the merit in physical spaces is that it allows for this kind of plurality to thrive. And so if we are moving towards digital realms, how do we keep that kind of dissent alive, even within our own circles that we speak to?
Yeah, I think,
Thank you, Pratima. Yeah, go ahead.
So just quickly, I think, what I was reminded of recently, I think you must have definitely gone there, is Ramakrishna Beach, Vizag. Right. And, morning and evening, it is just a fantastic public space. Right. And I think I don't know how it connects to this whole narrative, but I think the very fact that, this beautiful, amazing, power of nature, which is the sea, that enables, that kind of beautiful space to kind of open out, really, is an attractor. And I think, again, kind of pointing out to the fact that we really need to, in our design, of not just kind of outdoor spaces, also, it relates to indoors and buildings. We need to capture that essence which actually rejuvenates the soul. And maybe that would be a way forward to, distract the people from their mobile phones. But I may not be right. Who knows?
The Japanese have a term called Shirin Yoku, which translates loosely to forest bathing. And it's strangely found a way into their new constitution. So, I really appreciate that kind of privileging of putting nature as a centerpiece within architectural / cultural, spiritual seekings.
You can see the picture behind me is the Oval Maidan. And that's one of the open spaces which we managed to save in Mumbai. Even something as important as this has been so difficult to save. It's in the heart of the city. Finally, it was two women, one of whom was a lawyer, who spent almost 20 years of her life forming a group, an organization called Save the Oval. And that is why we even have this space behind us. So space and land and openness is becoming so precious in our country that it's for the next generation and all of you younger people on who are listening and who are part of the panelists to make sure that somehow you don't let this get occupied and taken away from us.
Great. Well, I just want to say before I put the next question across to you, Harsha, I spent a week, my New Year's Eve and a week, the Ramakrishna Beach in Vishakhapatnam. And the reason why you can't use the mobile phone over there is the sound of the ocean is so loud you can hardly.
Yeah. I think we lost Amar. Amar, you got cut in the middle.
Now talking about in lockdown, everybody is on Netflix, and the broadband is, is overheating here. That's why I'm struggling to keep in touch. Can you hear me now?
Yes, it's not perfect, but we can catch you. I think it's okay. You can continue.
Yeah. Well, the beach, I totally agree with you. I think it's one of the reason why I decided to spend a whole week there in Vishakhapatnam is because of the design, the whole recreational spectrum, and the opportunity to enjoy the environment. It's a good example. Now, one of the questions that's come up is, I don't know who's going to answer. There's so many comments and questions coming up from so many different countries. I'm trying to keep a track of them. Most of master plans, I think this is coming from Australia. There's so much focus on master plans dealing with urban density and a whole range of issues dealing with urbanism. How do you think, this is what they're asking, how do you think in future we would rethink this whole notion of urban density, rethink the notion of the master plans, that we are so caught up with? That's the question, I think, to all of you. Who wants to go first?
mean, I could go first if that's okay.
Yeah.
So I think it's a question which, you know, has been moving in my mind continuously, you know, for the past few weeks, right? Especially after, you know, I started hearing about Dharavi, right? And I think I personally believe that, my present understanding is that I think there are multiple factors that will inform density decisions in future. I think, I heard from some colleagues in US that, you know, certain denser parts of New York did not actually get as infected as certain other parts, you know. And I think the question was that, you know, I think there are two aspects. One is density and the other is the economic level located in that density. So I think because if it's highly dense, but you're extremely well-to-do people, you have the resources to actually plan each and every doorknob that you're going to touch, you know, till you enter your air-conditioned car. But I think if you are, you know, at another economic level, you probably cannot afford that density. And I think so, I think as we move forward, we need to do a lot of iterations to check what really now works, you know, and there should be no standard solution. Of course, you know, it has to be mixed use, but I believe that, you know, perhaps a little bit more relaxation, you know, of density at the lower economic level would be required, you know. That's how I see it presently, to be tested, you know, when I work further.
You know, the thing is, say, taking a city like Mumbai, where we have almost 30 to 40% migrants, most of these migrants are men. They're not, some of them come with their families, but a lot of them are individuals whose families are often in the villages. They come for 10 months in the year. They go back in April, May for the Rabi crop and for planting the rice crop, etc. So many times we've talked about, I remember when we were talking about the Eastern Seaboard and we had all these wonderful buildings, even in the mill area of Parel, old factories and, you know, mills, that any of these old wonderful stone buildings could have been converted into state-of-the-art, nice dormitories. You know, the central part of Mumbai in olden days, when the British were still here, there were different parts of the city which was called from Goa, from Cochin. And these were the people who came to work in the city. And the houses were built for them so that they could be there, that they would get good food, they would have a decent place to sleep at night, and they would be safe. And that completely went away with the chawl system and when the mills broke up. And we have so much of old buildings which could be recycled, retrofitted, rebuilt, and brought back to take care, to understand that what is the population made of? What is the population of Mumbai made of? What percentage are men? What percentage are women? Many people who come here for the first time and they walk around, they say, where are all the women? You only see men. And that's because most of the migrant population are men, single men or married men who have come into the city. Like in Dharavi also, you will see that in many, many other chawls and many other informal settlements. So we first have to understand the sociological aspect. We have to understand the economic aspect, as Harsh rightly says, before we can design or rebuild or retrofit or recycle within our cities.
To add to that, I think one
Brenda,
of
the, yeah.
Oh, sorry. One of the.
Can you unmute your mic? Yeah, there. Okay.
Yeah. Just to add, one of the, I think, just truths that COVID has got us face to face with is that, I think post-COVID, the future of work is radically going to change. I mean, there's been a bunch of industries and sectors.
I think Pratima is...
might lead to a shift.
So Pratima, we can't hear you. You're breaking up.
Hello.
So maybe that's true.
Pratima.
that the workforce itself, till she comes back to take her what she began, that the workforce itself, the type of jobs that we'll have, how people work, how is industry going to work. For instance, the farmers have realized today that they can directly supply the city of Mumbai without the middleman because of technology. And they've also realized they're making so much money. My entire building and all the people there, we are buying fruits from the farmers from Nashik, from Nagpur, from Pune, all directly. And there's no middleman. This is how jobs will change. And this is what, again, to come back, that technology has to come in and do many, many good things for our country post-COVID.
Yeah. Thanks, Brinda. Yeah, absolutely. There are some questions coming from Afghanistan and some of the countries that where there's a lot of infrastructure that's been built to promote tourism because of the growth of tourism in relation to job creation and poverty alleviation has been a very big priority because tourism has been for two decades the fastest growth industry. Now this COVID situation has had a devastating impact on tourism sector. So the question from Afghanistan is, how do it's one thing to say that we should stop traveling, we should cut down on tourism, but so much infrastructure has been built by designers and architects, you know, in anticipation of tourism for poverty alleviation. How do we deal with this? It's a catch-22 in a way, isn't it?
Who would like to? Harsh, would you like to answer?
I think it's a, yeah, I can go first, but it's a tough question because, you know, obviously we have been investing into sectors in anticipation of life continuing as usual, right? So if tourism makes money, let's exploit it. If, you know, visiting forests in the middle of, you know, protective parks, you know, works, you know, let's kind of convert it into a park and cut a road through it. So what can we, I mean, I think the answer would be short, medium, and long term. So short term, I believe, you know, some of these facilities need to relook at, you know, how flexible they are, right? Can they be converted and do something else, you know? And the short term might be about 6 months to 9 months when people may not be traveling much at all. As soon as we do get, let's hope we do get a vaccine, I think post that vaccine actually kind of, you know, being employed, you know, in a mass manner across Southeast Asia, we could probably, you know, start looking at, you know, people feeling more secure and start traveling. So I do believe that it's not like tourism is going to go away, right? I think it's just, you know, can we manage it in some manner that it becomes more sustainable? Can we say things like, I mean, I will only do two trips, you know, one local and one international a year, you know, and I'm not going to do more than that or maybe less than that, right? So that would be the way to look at it, you know, in a phased manner. Short term, try to be flexible, see what you can do. Long term, you know, plan for, you know, it actually becoming lesser, but then you can make your building flexible and do something else. And I think flexibility is going to be something big for planning new stuff related to tourism, right? Because in future, if such a thing happens again, I think tourism and construction are the two things that are going to hit very, very, very first, right? That's what I feel, Brinda. You want to go for it.
You know, I remember going to Venice recently and seeing the big cruise ships there and, you know, all these thousands of people coming out for the day to see. Now, that sort of tourism, that's just not going to be sustainable. That's going to devastate, I think, a lot of what we have preserved. I know Pratima may have some thoughts on this.
Well, actually, Brinda, we're supposed to have a conference in Dubrovnik exactly on what you're saying, an international research conference. It's been postponed to next year. And in Dubrovnik, because they face the same situation like in Barcelona and Venice and so on. Now, there's several questions that have come up. And I'm not going to, I just want the participants to bear with me. The next 18th of May, the next webinar 3 is on the 18th of May. And we're going to address a lot of questions that you're asking here about technology, museums, galleries, spaces. I have three fantastic people lined up for that, all museum people. So if you will bear with me, could we keep those questions? And I'll brief the panelists for the next webinar on the 18th of May, which is International Museum Day, with the questions that you're sending in. But I must say one thing, that there's too much hype about virtual access, virtual tours of museums and so on. But analysis has shown as of yesterday, can you hear me now? Can you hear me? You can
hear me?
Analysis has shown as of yesterday that in fact when museums like the Metropolitan, everybody started saying we are offering virtual tours, they only peaked for 4 days. And then they dramatically went down by 80%, because there's only, people are not satisfied with that. And they've really come down. So this idea of, you know, virtual tours in museums, all these things we'll address on the 18th of May. Now, what I wanted to ask is another question that's coming up is from several people, from Morocco, from various places, is documentation. Now, how are we documenting the resilience of people, communities during the lockdowns and the changed environment? How are we actually documenting it? And how is this going to be embedded into future planning? It's just coming from at least countries.
I think photographers have got the most exciting time because this is never going to come again in a hurry. And I don't know how many people have seen that lovely little video about animals doing all sorts of things in empty spaces. And they've got somewhere in Scotland, this group of sheep who have got into a children's playground and they're going round and round on the seesaws and the merry-go-rounds and everything. And it's just amazing, the photographs and the pictures and the videos that have come out of it. I just have so much fun looking at them. I couldn't help but share this with you.
Yeah, the merry-go-round is my favorite.
Yes, mine too.
Do you want to comment, Pratima? You're about to say something, please.
Yeah, I am. One of the projects that really excited me that's been out recently is dreaming in the time of COVID. And there's a project, I think that it's emerging from a university in Canada. But somebody's sharing sort of what we are as a species dreaming about during the time of COVID. And it really is some way of trying to capture the zeitgeist, but at least always on this unconscious or subconscious plane. So I think that in this moment, a lot of people have turned towards documentation, and it's a documentation that is pushing the boundaries of what's considered cultural artifacts, which I find super interesting.
So Amar, I think I could add a little bit to it. I think it's a very interesting question because I feel we would need to really understand which portions of India, which districts, which communities, which, you know, kind of sub parts of cities actually reacted like in which manner, right, during this crisis. Because I think suppose, you know, this thing happens again, because there are chances of, you know, other waves coming in. I hope that it doesn't happen. But what, you know, we would really need to document, you know, in a traditional sense, you know, if I were to just take this question, is that, you know, how did, you know, what was the density? What were the people there? How many shops were used to serve those people? You know, how many cleaning staff really, you know, attended, you know, how many cases actually emerged from it? You know, how fast was the decline, you know, in terms of cases that happened there? And somehow, you know, establish a little bit of statistical science behind it so as to glean some understanding of how communities can be made more resilient. Because I think it would then impact, you know, even levels to our understanding about master planning, you know, kind of residential neighborhoods. Because, you know, what do you need, you know, in, let's say, 1 by 1 kilometer? Do you need really a small clinic, and or do you need a school which can be quickly converted into let us say, a disaster shelter in case of something happens. You know, those kind of things have to be gleaned. I haven't really come across the government really publishing anything on that, but it's a very interesting question of how it could be done, right? Needs to be done, I think.
Just to add to that,
I think Harsh.
To add to that, so my group, the group I work with at the Media Lab is called Space Enabled. And what they use is to use space-based technologies, but to look back inward at Earth and like work on projects related to social justice. And one of our projects that we're using, that we're trying to develop during times of COVID, is to use satellite data and Earth observation that maps various factors, whether it's like the ecological to density, to the prevalence of the spread of the COVID vectors. But then they're trying to use those algorithms on satellite data and try to populate it with like user experiences. And like emerging knowledge on the ground to try and provide some sort of a platform as a future mitigation strategy. And we're currently doing this work in some parts of Ecuador, in Brazil, and in Ghana and Benin.
All right.
But it would be lovely to see an India version of this.
Thank you, Pratima. Harsh, I think you actually anticipated several questions in your last answer about the informal workers, you know, and also Brenda talked about, you know, the technology as a means, you know, to deal with the informal workers, because one of my colleagues from Anand, Dr. Ashima Sood, and there are a number of people from another five countries have asked something very similar. Vendors, auto drivers, waste pickers, you know, they do so much to sustain civic spaces in our part of the world. What can we do to, you know, the livelihoods of these workers? You know, with the public spaces closed down, but how in future we could integrate informal workers in a more recognized way? Because the question about tourism came from several people, but 80% of people working in the tourism sector in India are in the informal sector, you know. So how does one deal with the livelihood of people in the informal sectors who sustain our civic spaces, keep them going? There's at least several people are asking that question. Anybody wants to take that on?
I think one thing which I would like to say, coming back to my city, is that all this will become much more important with a moving migrant population. If the people who live in the city get a sense of ownership and feel that they belong to the city. And that is why everything that exists in the city is equally important to them. So whether it's saving the Central Vista in Delhi or whether it's saving the Oval Maidan, if everybody in the city has a sense of belonging, a sense of identity with the city, irrespective of which part of India they come from. And how can you do that? What are the ways you can give people that sense of belonging, that sense of place, a sense of time? I think those questions need to be answered.
Brenda, you hit the nail on the head. Ever since I came back after 43 years back to India, the one thing that I found in so many DPRs, detailed project reports for people who are overseas, and most of them, what I've found is they talk about stakeholders. And when they talk about stakeholders, it's all the government officials, it's all top down. And there's one meeting where a community representative is brought in as a token. And the notion of stakeholders in India is, I find it shocking. I've rarely come across something which is inclusive like what you're suggesting, Brenda. And I think that we need to stop. We need to stop this very urban, upper middle class rhetoric of the other. And I think that Pratima, right in the beginning, you know, pointed out that this othering process that is so embedded, you know, so embedded in our way of working in India as well as many other countries, it needs to change and we need to rethink. Pratima, are you going to say something here? No. Yeah. Harsh, do you think it is possible, Harsh? Do you think we could rethink in India? You know, like if it's the same thing, you know, cultural mapping, everybody does cultural mapping, but if somebody parachutes into a place, they've already come up with a framework, they prepare a cultural map and it gets funded. It's not even localized. There are no local voices, you know, sort of, there are no multiple narratives, but everything is to get towards, okay, what would sell for tourism? What would sell for design? What would sell for creating another space? What do you think?
I think there was an initial question, and then I think the answers kind of alluded to some other, you know, big issues as well. So I think just starting from what I heard, you know, regarding, you know, the question on informal sector, you know, how do we kind of, you know, see that getting managed, and then that connecting to, you know, the fact that do they have a voice, you know, when it comes to kind of planning our urban spaces or, you know, our buildings or cities. So I think the first one, you know, is that, you know, yesterday was, I think, 1st May, Labor Day, right? And I think we have seen many times in the world that, you know, in the end, you know, if things are, you know, not organized in some manner, either it's socially or, you know, kind of legally or politically, right, there would be a chance for people to exploit. So I think when it comes to informal sector, what I see is it to become more formalized. You know, let me give you an example, right? So you've seen street vendors, right? Street vendors, you know, they're everywhere and they need to be. They actually, you know, fulfill a very important requirement, you know, for the city, you know, in Indian cities. But I think there was quite an interesting policy that came around, I think, 2015 by Government of India, which I thought was quite nice. Basically, they said that we're not going to kind of disturb, you know, what you're doing. The only thing we want you to do is you come and you register, right? That you are an informal vendor on this road in this part of the city, and, you know, take away a list of, you know, kind of hygiene and precautions that you need to take, right? So what started off, you know, as very simple, I think also gave them a little leverage where they could actually say that, okay, we are holding, you know, a market, you know, at night in a certain part of the city, you know, these people can actually kind of come and, you know, hold that, right? So I think what I'm hinting at is there would be certain kind of formalization that will be required, whether it is, you know, people working at home, whether it's our drivers, whether it's people, you know, kind of working, you know, on the road, which will enable them to really get into the, you know, just for example, you know, Government of India, I thought it was a great policy to kind of look at opening digital bank accounts, right, for you know, kind of people in the lower economic segment, I think, which was, I believe, beneficial to an extent during this period, right? So something like that could have to happen. Regarding their voices being heard, I believe the only way forward on that would be, I think there is, and there's going to be a big role for activism, right? People will have to come together. They have to really make themselves heard.
Brenda has been saying. Yeah.
They have to say, this is my city. You know, you better hear, you know, hear what we want. You know, we are here to stay, right? That's how it's going to happen.
All right. Well, there's some more questions relating to books, libraries, artifacts, and so on. I will defer. I'll put those questions to the next webinar's panel, which is on the International Museums Day. But one thing that's come up in the last webinar, and again here, at least three people have raised the same issues, is the whole question of mental health, you know, with social isolation. And what came up last time and again now is the notion of civic space as we reimagine it. How do we reimagine it as an inclusive space? Because right now there is this kind of deficit model, if you will, of mental health and any kind of ability or disability that we add on. You know, sort of there's a compliance from government 2016 legislation, so we add on things. But how do we integrate? So the question from three people, if I were to pull it together into one, is how can public spaces be reimagined, designed as inclusive spaces, which also take into consideration the well-being of people, meaning people with mental health challenges? It's a very big issue because we got what statistically 1 out of 7 people in India struggle with a mental health issue. 1 out of 7. Anyone wants to have a go?
So I could have a very very simple go at it, and I think it's a complex question. You know, mental health is a big issue. It is an important issue, and I think built environment, you know, and design has a role to play with it, right? I think one aspect of mental health would be how people engage with other people, right? Whether a space really allows you, you know, kind of the openness, you know, the safety, right? And acceptance in which a person can share his heart out, right? And interact with somebody else. Whether it's really sitting on a bench and actually kind of watching somebody else do something and learn from it and go away happy, or it is actually really joining a community meeting in a park, right? So all of, you know, these are enabled, you know, by a framework which is very physical. You know, that's what we do as architects. But there is more to it, right? There would be many more layers to it.
Well, we're running out of time and there are lots of questions coming in. I just want the participants to know that all these questions will be consolidated into clusters and I'll share them with the panelists. And once the responses come back, we'll synthesize them and publish them. But you will have a record, a voice record, a sound bite, by next week uploaded onto the site, and you'll all be informed about it. I mean, the limited amount of time that's there, could I ask each one of the panelists to say something that you want to say and you haven't had an opportunity so far? Come on, Brinda, let's start with you.
I thought we'll start with Pratima this time. Okay, I'll just
say she has the last word. She has the
last word, yeah. Well, short of feeling very sad about what has happened to a lot of people in my country, I have to say that this time has been different and in a way enjoyable in its own way for me. It's made us think differently. It's given us time to actually sit and address issues perhaps and look around the world. I got a small video from a very good friend of mine, an architect in New York. She's the architect for the Obama Library that's coming up in Chicago. And she said, Brinda, we always walk with our feet, but during this time, I have to learn to walk with my hands. And then when we go back again, we'll have to reverse this. So what we're all trying to say is this huge change that we all have to deal with mentally and physically and where it's going to take us when we get back, if we get back to a new normal. I don't think anyone on earth at least has the answer.
Thank you, Brenda. Harsh, do you want to go next?
Yes, absolutely. So I think regarding life after lockdown and the new normal, I think it'll be very interesting. I would like to leave this discussion by throwing out like a little kind of idea or a challenge. You know, do you think, you know, if we have enjoyed these few weeks in this, enjoyed in the sense that, you know, we found them as enlightening in some ways, then do you think as people, as humanity, we would be open to, you know, kind of slowing down, you know, every year for 2 to 3 months, right? And really actually taking this break every year, which actually gives a break to the nature, because I don't see any other, you know, kind of way for us to kind of, you know, impose a slowdown, right? We don't want it to be imposed, but it should rather come from inside. So that's a question I want to kind of leave everybody with. You think we are open for a self-imposed slowdown, let me call it, every year for 2 months?
Absolutely. We have no choice.
Like summer holidays.
Actually, one of the things that I've been sort of thinking about for a while now, a little before COVID sort of forced my attention to it, is actually about grief and about climactic grief. I mean, we've reached a point as a species on this earth where we've kind of already sealed the gravestone or the tombstone on like a host of other species, on a host of ecosystems, on several of the planet's ability to regeneratively function. And I've been thinking a lot about what the role of grief is as a method to navigate this. And you know, like, and grief is cultural. Most of the time when I live in America and I watch the performance of grief, it's such a private, ritual. But then I think back to like how grief was performed as a child growing up, like in India, that it has always been communal. And I think of this, like I'm starting to think very much of this moment as a period of grief to like recognize that some things, you know, whether it's our lifestyle, certain habits and attachment to a certain type of consumption, I think it's a moment to bid goodbye to that and then look at how we emerge from this as if it were a chrysalis. And so I think that there has to be a deep, almost ineffable sadness associated with this period, but also a grief. Grief is a celebration, right, of life. And right now with the bird song and the peacocks and the flamingos and all of the animals who found their ways to seesaws, and it is also a celebration of life. And so I think that to walk this duality between grief and celebration is something that I'm thinking about. And, like, I hope.
Beautiful, Pratima. We need to look forward to a better tomorrow. You know, we can't, especially my generation can't leave to your generation, you know. We got to live a better tomorrow. Now, I just want to say that several people are asking, you know, will there be a recording? Yes, there will be. Actually, this is being recorded with some minor editing for sound, etc. It'll be uploaded next week. And I think that to close the webinar, I just want to say that what a fantastic, you know, mix of brains. You know, there's a brain trust over here in this webinar within a short period, you know, to address so many different issues. And self-imposed slowdown. You're getting a lot of thumbs up. A lot of people love it, Harsh. Self-imposed slowdown. And I think a lot of people love what Brinda said, this whole thing of she's very optimistic that because we have the capacity and capability to maximize on that digital access, you know, through the percentage of people who using phones, even though the kind of access is very, desegregated because at what level that access is there. But Brinda is, you know, eloquently said in dealing with, especially the informal sector, this could play an important role. And I think that Pratima has brought us back to the human dimension of all of this. It's not just scientific reports. In fact, there was one question which we didn't have a chance to address, where I forget which country, they were really concerned that there's so much emphasis on the scientific, the philosophical, the human side will be forgotten. I think Pratima brought us back to, you know, the human face to all of this. It's been great. And those of you who are still there, about 90 people are still on that. The recording will be uploaded. All the questions, we'll aggregate them and send them to the panelists, and whatever they send, there'll be a paragraph that'll go up. The next webinar is on the 18th of May, which is International Museum Day, but it will be in the evening at 7:30 because I have somebody from Barbados, Bridgetown, Barbados. One of the most powerful speeches was given by the Prime Minister of Barbados yesterday on the whole COVID situation. And on CNN. So I've got the former president of UNESCO and former president of International Council of Museums. She's from a small island development state, first woman, first black woman to be the president of UNESCO. So she's joining us on the 18th. And then the former deputy minister for culture of Berlin is joining us. He also became the president of International Council of Museums. Don't forget, I was the former vice president of International Council of Museums. And then European museums are opening up. So the Secretary General of International Council of Museums of Austria, she's like Pratima, she's the next generation, she's joining. So a lot of questions that were not answered because people asked about museums as civic spaces, libraries as civic spaces. We'll take them up on the 18th of May, International Museum Day. It's wonderful that they, 1 hour, 35 minutes, there's still 87 people, you know, unique participants engaged. This is wonderful. I've been in webinars where by now everybody's gone. Thank you very much. Thank you to all the panelists. This has been fantastic. Thank you very much. And Sharvari and your mate in the background, thank you for making it all work. You can see Sharvari now. She's another very young person without whom I don't think I'll be able to do what I'm doing. And Vishal Bhai, is, he doesn't want to be seen. He's hiding. Vishal is the technical wizard who makes everything happen. So for a fantastic webinar. Thank you, everyone. Be Thank safe. You. Be safe. Take care.
Thank you, Amar. Thank you.
Thanks.
You got the red button at the bottom. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for joining. We'll be closing now. Thank you.